So, if I may
Welcome everyone back for the final session of this wonderful event. It is my great pleasure to introduce someone who will be moderating and commenting on the or asking questions or inviting questions. This is Susan's play multiple roles, but my whole usual role is simply to introduce her, and it is a great pleasure to do so. She has been a wonderful friend and personally and publicly, I suppose, a brilliant scholar. And she has a very close association with Cambridge. She is officially the professor of international law at the LSE. She has written several brilliant books and Very Global Constitutions, The False Tree of Liberty. And has your book on Shoganini come out?
Needs to.
It's over there. Goodness. Okay, let's go and get a copy. Because that was a wonderful series of lectures, the Lauterbach lectures on the concept of dignity. So it is with great pleasure, Susan, that I hand over the proceedings to you.
Thank you so much, Tony, and thanks also to the organizers of this fabulous event. We're here to celebrate the work and honor the memory of Karen Knott. Karen should have been here delivering the Herschel Lauterbach Memorial Lectures at this time, but deprived of her, we're left to discuss her extraordinary legacy ourselves. My association with Karen was mainly as a friend. We just did fun stuff together. We did write one article together, and it was for a fest trip with James Crawford, co-edited by Christine Chinglin. That had to do with cliché in international law. It was quite a difficult piece to write. We nearly fell out in a number of moments, you know. We're both pretty fussy about how far we write, but also because, actually more importantly, we didn't agree on how to pronounce the word. She pronounced it in the North American way, cliché. I pronounce Australian and British. Anyway, starting point in this piece was Martin Amis's collection of essays and reviews the war against cliché. And he spoke of writing as a campaign against clichés of the pen, but also clichés of the mind, clichés of the heart. And he opposed cliché to the qualities of freshness, energy, and reverberation of voice. We found in working on this topic that obviously cliché is a pejorative term, and we're all invited to avoid it. If clichés ask you not to think, if clichés switch off your brain and are a mode of non-thought, a kind of automatism, literary scholars remind us that you can always decline the invitation not to think. You can always use them in different ways. So to put it differently, we found that if clichés are first thoughts, we all have the capacity for second thoughts. So rather than banning clichés, literary scholars tell us that we can use them productively by doing something with them. Anyway, bans don't work because clichés were really so worthless. Why would they have such tenacity? Why would they have such hold on us? Clichés are often thought of as dead metaphors that have lost their charge and their original sense. But again, we learn from scholars of metaphor that they're really more like sleeping or dormant metaphors, which can be reawakened through creative deployment. The reawakening of dormant or sleeping metaphors is the stuff of much everyday and literary verbal playfulness. If you think of the work of Samuel Beckett or James Joyce, much modernist literature, it's often about reawakening dead metaphors, recovering their literal sense and playing around with it, defamiliarizing a metaphor that seems to have lost its original sense. Of course, the emergence of cliches is a matter of repetition. And repetition, it's integral to the juris generative process. But as a problem of legal thought, cliché is said to evince sterility, degeneration, the lack of reflection. Clichés, we're told, won't go away, even if we want that to happen. Rather, we should use them, know them, and use them knowingly as one scholar. Well, I mention all of this because, of course, self-determination is one of the greatest clichés of international law. How many people have said or seen in an exam the question, which is a quote from Ivor Jennings' book about the approach to self-government in 1956, that people cannot decide until somebody decides who are the people, or Judge Dillard's statement in Western Sahara, it's for the people to determine the destiny of the territory and not the territory, the destiny of the people, or simply self-determination is the antithesis of uti possidetis discuss. So, We're in the realm of cliché. However, what's significant here, of course, is the way in which self-determination, the cliché, is reawakened in Karen's work and in the work of our other interlocutors in these lectures today and yesterday. In their work and in her work, self-determination becomes capacious, vital, and urgent in its implications. And this relates both to the concept of self-determination itself and to the methods by which we produce knowledge about it. So just to remind you of some of what we've heard over the last couple of days, we heard from Marty that self-determination isn't simply a script waiting to be made real. It's a set of questions, and here he was borrowing from Gaucher about public authority and its constitution, about horizontal relations in society, and about our experience of time and history, our sense of the legacy of the past, and the vision of the future, and a vision of the future and how that relates to the present. Marty also highlighted the way in which the emphasis in Karen's work was on the private side of international law and self-determination. We'll come back to that a bit later. And we've just heard about that as well from Roxana. But in for Marty, it was an emphasis on the affective and cultural side of things. And he linked that with this sense, which he finds in the work of Bourget, that there's something about our être ensemble, something about our way of living together, our human coexistence, that needs updating and that legalism can't supply. From Megan, we heard that self-determination isn't just a right or doctrine, but again, a place to ask some questions and have new conversations about international law as a project of coexistence in diversity. In particular, she put before us questions about the sites of legal interpretation and how Karen brings alive the interpretative agency and interpretative participation of a wide range of non-standard actors. Christine focused on a series of encounters, a word that recurs in Karen's scholarship. These were issues not often recognized as relevant to self-determination in mainstream scholarship, yet Christine highlighted the way in which they go to the heart of what self-determination might mean for women and more generally for a gendered perspective on the topic. So issues of identity and belonging, autonomy, sexual autonomy, self-expression and decision-making, and overall the organization of national society. And she highlighted three areas that bring these matters into focus: the discriminatory nationality laws on which Karen wrote, the gap between the right to participation in post-World War I plebiscites, self-determination, seemingly, but also the denial of self-determination, the denial of access to self-chosen identity involved in discrimination, indiscriminatory nationality laws. Secondly, the Tokyo Women's Tribunal. Here, Christine brought out a sense in Karen's work of self-determination as doing our own thing. These crimes, as women, these crimes had been omitted from official processes after Second World War. The Tokyo military, Far East Military Tribunal, with that complicated acronym, seemingly no redress for these so-called conflict women. They were excluded from the peace processes. So women took matters into their own hands, set up a people's tribunal as a self-devised solution to this gap, to this exclusion. So here we saw we gained a sense of self-determination as not only the struggle of peoples to become part of a world of sovereign states, as Christine put it, but the struggle of individuals to have their story brought into international law. I thought that was a beautiful way of putting it. And then finally, thirdly, the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp, on which Karen was working at the end. This is yet another sense of self-determination as community building. This participatory collective autonomy reflected in this women-only camp, modeling, as Christine brought out, a desired social and political outcome by enacting it, a form of prefigurative politics. So we gained a variety of senses of self-determination, but we also, as I said, learned something or were reminded of things in Karen's work about the methods we can use for producing knowledge about self-determination. Many of the speakers used sensory language with reference to Karen, so we were invited to listen to her voice and of course heard her voice through quotations and through these evocations of her wonderful scholarship. In addition, there was much made of her gaze, her very distinctive way of seeing and looking. For Megan, Karen had a particularly penetrating regard of a distinctively activist and ethically charged kind, which was, we might also observe, never judgmental, much less self-righteous. Her paper by referencing Karen's contribution to Imrie Tallgren's recent volume of portraits of women in international law. And Mai invited us to think about Karen's very particular ways of seeing, introducing also John Berger's scholarship, or that's a writing on that same topic, or rather his what began as a TV series in 1972, Ways of Seeing, where John Berger, as Mai highlighted, talked about how we're surrounded by the world. It encircles us. So what we see depends on where we stand and how and when we look. And Mai quoted that section from Berger where he said that we only see what we choose to look at. Looking is an act of choice. It's never innocent. And moreover, we never look at just one thing. We're always looking at relations between things and ourselves, or between some things and other things. Karen is inviting us to look in a way that, of course, as we know, centers the historic exclusion of women, and that brings into focus other exclusions in the process. So when we look at exclusions based on gender, whenever, as Berger tells us, looking at one thing, we're always looking at intersectional exclusion, multiplicities of exclusion. It's an invitation, as Mai put it, to see the world as a feminist would see it, which is not just seeing women, but more generally a method of seeing what's hidden, seeing from the margins. from those vantage points that reveal, as in the Hans Holbein painting, not just the pompous and extravagantly dressed ambassadors, but also the skull in the work. So it's a gaze, as Maya again beautifully put it, that looks at women as actors in and against international law, that looks with self-determination but without being limited by its canon. Maya also highlighted the spectacular and unspectacular violence in Palestine. And Megan also commented on the ways in which self-determination has taken on fresh kinds of prominence from Palestine to Chagos, Ukraine and Greenland, and how those of us who felt comfortable with our self-determination in parts of the world, safe, rich parts of the world, are coming to experience something of the dislocation and lack of control permanently felt by others. And Anna expanded on that discussion of these current focal points for self-determination. Similarly, I think highlighting the way in which anxieties have come to Europe and North America. Roxana connected all of this with Karen's preoccupations with private international law, the lost private history of international law, its quotidian transnational life that connects foreign affairs with questions of family law, Solomon's Island legal status, nationality and immigration, property and succession. And in all this, as Roxana emphasized, private international law must be understood as not just marginal to issues of self-determination, but deeply entrenched, enmeshed, I really meant to say there, with them. And not just the recent result of late 20th and 21st century globalization, but a reflection of transnational interactions in the long history of imperial expansion and the struggle against it. I'd like to end this brief wrap up with a personal reminiscence of mine own, which bears on some of these issues. I last saw Karen before the pandemic, actually, at an exhibition we went to together at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London on Mary Quant. For those who don't know who Mary Quant is, she was a fashion designer and a fashion icon in this country, associated with the idea, with the concept of the swinging 60s. So her heyday was the 1960s. And she became associated with the introduction of the miniskirt, of hot pants, of colored tights, something to which I was partial in for a long period of my life. So, eye makeup. She launched, it said, a fashion revolution on the British high street, taking fashion out of stuffy department stores and couture salons, making clothes for the mass market. Mary Quant's approach to clothing was and makeup was playful, colorful, and inventive. Karen loved that exhibition. She loved the clothes, the bags and shoes, and even the makeup that was on display there. Well, those who knew Karen will not be surprised by that. She was a fantastically stylish person with a highly developed aesthetic sensibility, a modernist sensibility, true to her Danish roots. And I want to suggest that there is yet another sense of self-determination made vivid here. Mary Quant's designs point us towards self-determination as self-possession. Of course, that's part of its meaning, going back to Fountain Beyond, but also self-determination as boldness, creativity, and a healthy dose of attitude. So that concludes what I want to say by way of wrap up.